We're coming to you from the trenches. I'm Bree Hayden.
So what we're seeing is these budget deficits used as an excuse to take more and more money away from classrooms, away from the services that students need directly.
Coming up, we'll learn more about recently announced Chicago public school closings and their impacts on the community.
To be a citizen is to be able to converse, to be able to think clearly, think critically, and share that in conversation.
And we'll hear from Robert Jensen, the author of a new book on critical thinking and its importance in addressing the world's major problems. But first, here's some headlines from the Indie Media Network around the world. The Greek government shut down Athens Indie Media and two other progressive independent news outlets on April 11th as part of a sweeping campaign to crush dissent that opposes their austerity schemes and state-sponsored repression. The Athens Indie Media Collective released a statement which read in part, "Three of the contra-information media of the antagonistic movement, Athens.indiemedia.org, Radio 98FM, and Radio and Tassi are facing state repression. In a period where the whole of the society finds it difficult even to breathe due to harsh economic, political, and social repression, smaller or larger resistances, solidarity of workers in their collective struggles, give courage and hope, pass on the flaming signals of revolution, inspire and plant the seeds of subversive and radical ideas needed to tear down, once and for all, this world of exploitation. Efforts to restore the resources online have temporarily succeeded. An online search shows that the National Technical University of Athens has provided a physical home and server space for the outlets. Athens Indie Media is, as of late April 2013, online at athens.indiemedia.org. O'o Te Aurora Indie Media in New Zealand featured the story of four Maori people who were denied justice by the New Zealand Supreme Court. Quoting from the feature, dated April 23rd, "The Supreme Court has today refused to hear the appeal of the four people convicted of firearms charges in relation to the 2007 police raids around the country. The four people, Rangi Kamara, Urs Signer, Emily Bailey, and Tame Iti, endured a 6-week-long trial in Auckland last year where the jury was hung on the substantive charge of participation in an organized criminal group. The four were convicted on a handful of firearm charges relating to legal possession. The four were tried using illegal obtained video footage acquired by the police by trespassing and planting cameras. The organized criminal group law has been heavily criticized by lawyers internationally as a sloppy law that allows prosecution absent any actual criminal act or even the plan of a criminal act. Essentially, just talking about a criminal act among people is enough to constitute a crime." IndieBay highlighted a call to protest one of the world's premier trade organizations, the Indonesian People's Movement Against Neocolonialism Imperialism, has called for solidarity efforts in Asia and around the world in anticipation of the 2013 ministerial meeting of the World Trade Organization, scheduled to take place in Bali, Indonesia, on December 3rd through December 6, 2013. The ministerial coincides with international efforts to push through dubious trade agreements, like the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, encompassing all of the countries around the Pacific Rim, and a proposed U.S.-European Union Free Trade Agreement. The call has already listed many dozens of Indonesian and international supporters. Protests have helped force the collapse of WTO ministerials in the past, including those in Seattle in 1999 and in Cancun, Mexico in 2003. Twin Cities Indie Media featured the anti-labor efforts of a nonprofit Minnesota food provider. Quoting from the feature, "On April 24th, Sisters Camelot, a nonprofit mobile food shelf engaged in a 2-month-long strike of its canvas workers, rejected a settlement offer from the National Labor Relations Board, opting instead to fight the union in court. In order to do so, they have hired a right-wing professional union avoidance attorney, John C. Hodge, from Ford Harrison, a nationwide anti-labor law firm. Canvassers of the progressive organization are concerned that Hodge is seeking to set precedents against independent contractors' rights. The canvassers are seeking support from other unions and organizations. Chicago Indie Media featured the developments in the NATO 5 case, reporting that one of the five people accused of terrorism during the 2012 NATO summit in Chicago has taken a guilty plea after almost a full year in jail. Quoting from the feature, Mark Nawim, a 28-year-old Chicago activist, pleaded guilty in Cook County Court on April 11th to felony charges brought on by interactions with undercover Chicago police officers. The officers had infiltrated activist groups prior to last May's NATO protest. Nawim, who had spent 329 continuous days in the appalling conditions of Cook County Jail while awaiting trial, will now serve out the remainder of a 3-year sentence in a state prison. He is expected to receive credit for time served and other reductions in the duration of his incarceration for good behavior. Rachel Unterman of the NATO 5 Defense Committee said in response, "The politically motivated prosecution and abuse of Mark suffered in Cook County Jail point to a degree of coordinated state repression and coercion which was physically and psychologically unbearable." Those are some recent headlines. For more news and headlines from Chicago and around the world, go online to the Chicago Indie Media website at chicago.indiemedia.org. We're coming to you from the trenches.
Yeah, feel this from the bottom of my heart, y'all. Truly inspired. Here we go. Come on, look, y'all. Yo, homie, I was taught by a Chicago teacher. Chicago teacher, Chicago teacher. I learned to read and write from a Chicago teacher. So I'm inspired by the fight from my Chicago teachers. Homie, I was taught by a Chicago teacher. Chicago teacher, Chicago teacher. I learned to read and write from a Chicago teacher. So I'm inspired by the fight from my Chicago teachers. The teachers are tired, the students dumbfounded. The budgets get cut, so classes are overcrowded. Streets full of violence, the blue coat is silence. So I'ma keep rhyming till salaries start rising. The unions are rising, taking to the streets. The workers are united, so the mayor's got beef. Rhymes a fake pretender with a corporate agenda. Neoliberal offender, of course you offend.
The Chicago Teachers Union has made its presence felt in the past school year, most notably with a nationally recognized week-long school strike which won concessions from city authorities. Now, the CTU and public school supporters are facing a threat as the city has announced the closing of 54 Chicago public schools. The schools' closings raise the ire of the union, who say that the closings are made on dubious grounds and are bound to do more harm than good for students and teachers. To learn more about the impacts of the school closings and efforts to oppose the closings, we'll now hear from Shion Barrett, a teacher and organizer who was interviewed by Chicago Indie Media's Mitchell Szczepańczyk on Sunday, April 21st, 2013.
We are joined on the phone with Shion Barrett. Shion Barrett is a law and Chicago history teacher at Gage Park High School, part of the Chicago Public Schools, and is also involved with the Caucus of Rank and File Educators as well as the Chicago Teachers Union. Shion, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Mitchell. It's great to be here.
Great that you could join us. Tell us a little bit about the protest that the Chicago's Teachers Union had helped to organize in the wake of a number of announced Chicago public school closings in March. What's the rationale for the protest?
These school closings are based on false reasoning by the city that it will save us money in a budget crisis, which all the studies shows not to be the case. But more than that, it's about the fact that these school closings would seriously damage tens of thousands of students' education and place many young people's lives at risk through increased threats to their safety, both commuting to and from school and also within schools themselves. What we've seen this year, and it's not just been this year, it's been a process over the last 5 years or so, is that the city has become more and more unified against the idea of these school closings. I remember with CORE, with the Caucus of Rank and File Educators, when we started going to these hearings 4 or 5 years ago, often at some of the school closing hearings, it'd be a couple people from the community, a few of us from CORE, and then the hearing officer, and that's all. And over the years, it grew and grew to the point that this year, by our estimates, you know, in the first round of hearings, there were 20,000 parents and community members, educators who attended the hearings. The vast majority, without almost to a single person, opposing the closings. And this rally was a way to bring those parents, those community members, teachers, students, together in one place to make a statement that these closings are unjust and they're damaging to students.
There was a protest lockdown of sorts. I think it was the number, I see the number of something like 130 to 150 people that were arrested or detained outside of the Chicago public schools in the response. I take it that this was kind of like, okay, we're serious about this so much so that we're going to risk getting arrested. Is that what the whole point of that was?
Absolutely. I mean, it's the idea that the education of young people and the safety of young people is something that many, many, many of us are willing to take personal risk to defend. And yes, I mean, none of us wants to get arrested, but if it's about the safety of a child or the safety of 40,000 children, then there are many of us that are willing to take that risk to try to protect.
To your knowledge, do you know if any of those 130 or 150 people who were detained, did they ever get arrested? Did they get charged? Do you know what's going to happen?
I believe for that particular action, people were given a ticket. You know, they were cuffed and processed, but then they were released.
So no charges or anything?
Correct.
Tell us a little bit more about the budget rationale for the closings. You had said that there was false reasoning made by the city regarding that these closings, while lamentable, are necessary in order to help to fulfill budget shortfalls. But you're saying that that's not true. Can you explain a little bit why that's not true?
Absolutely. I mean, first of all, what we're talking about is a common strategy that's being used across the country and you know, in many ways around the world, where budget deficits are used as excuses to cut vital social services. And in many of the cases, especially places like Chicago, those budget deficits are not only, you know, wouldn't be a good justification anyway, but in this case, they're exaggerated or fabricated. We did a study, a number of my students at Julian High School, and then several other members of CORE did a study, I think it's been 3 years ago now, that showed that over the last 5 years, CPS's initial budget deficit estimates and then their actual implemented budget had an average of a $355 million discrepancy each year. Always on the side of exaggerating deficits and usually ending with a surplus. And that's, you know, as that hasn't been interrogated and hasn't been stopped, the city has gotten bolder and bolder. So last year, again, they had said that there was going to be a $1 billion deficit. And then when the final report came out by an independent auditor, it showed that the district had ran a approximately $500 million surplus. And so we in Chicago, you know, we could fund our schools better. New York City funds quite a bit more per child. Right nearby where our mayor is actually from, and a lot of the money that went into his election came from, in Winnetka, the per student funding is two to three times what it is in Chicago. But that being said, we do have a $5 billion budget for Chicago Public Schools, and the percentage that's been spent on the classrooms has continued to drop over the last 10 years. So what we're seeing is these budget deficits used as an excuse to take more and more money away from classrooms, away from the services that students need directly, and moving them to privatization, moving them to private contractors, large interest payments to banks, and then also lots of pet and experimental programs. The comments often made that as a society we don't fund education what we should, it's not that those aren't true. It's just that if you're not appropriating the money correctly, just getting more money isn't the only solution, or cutting expenses isn't really a solution. You have to appropriate your money properly. And in Chicago, the people have no say in that. We have a appointed school board, and so it's really whatever the mayor's appointees want to put their money into, or our money into. And so you get situations like this where the very function of giving a child a safe place to go to school close to their home begins to be withdrawn in favor of, you know, whatever program the mayor's appointees would rather do.
And that kind of dovetails a little bit into one of the points that you had raised regarding the false reasoning as to the rationale regarding the closings. The fact that, as you had mentioned, lives would be at risk. Can you elaborate a little bit more on some of the ways in which lives would be at risk by these closings that it seems like would be, you would figure something like that would be far removed from putting people's lives in risk? Explain a little bit about what the connection is.
Sure. I mean, academically, you have the studies, you know, the Paul and UIC researchers have done studies of previous school closing waves in Chicago and found, never to this extent, but even on a smaller level, what they're now calling welcoming schools, but have always been called receiving schools, the schools that the kids are sent to once their school is closed, have experienced spikes in violence. And so that's at the academic end. I mean, I can understand the academics, but I think, like many listeners, to me, it's the kid-by-kid experience that really affects me. I mean, just in this round of testimony about these school closings, we've had students crying in terror at what they're going to face. We've had a student read off of the Facebook page threats from students at the welcoming school about how they were going to jump them once they came in. You know, Chicago is a very divided place. We're segregated by race, but we're also segregated along gang outlines and criminal organizations. And while it may seem from downtown, from 125 South Clark, we can simply move these 100 kids from here to here, and it'll go off without a hitch. We have to understand that each one of those extra steps could be terrifying if it's across a gang line or if it's into an area that a student knows is not safe. And so, you know, on the best case scenario, you've got a lot of students who are terrorized. And then, of course, the you know, unthinkable, but what happens every day in our streets of Chicago is that the worst case scenario, which is that we lose a precious young person to violence. And I'm not saying that if we don't close these schools, that will go away. But all evidence points to the fact that we always say, you know, never again, we can't allow this youth violence taking away our young people to continue. And yet we're making a choice as a city to do something that will, by all evidence, exacerbate it, make it much worse.
It seems to me that the powers that be regarding the Chicago public schools that might be orchestrating this, it seems are kind of guided by like deep-seated ignorance with regards to the decisions that they make on this score, that they may just be completely oblivious, even despite the fact that there may be ample testimony and research and so forth, saying that people's lives are going to be at risk if these decisions are made, and they're just pretending that it's just not there. Do you think that that's part of the rationale for this?
Absolutely, Mitchell. And I mean, I have to, the part of me that's a teacher has to hope that it's ignorance, because that's something we can educate. I mean, the more horrifying possibility is that they simply don't care, and the priorities that they have regarding their relationships and, you know, the powers in the city, they prioritize over the lives of children, as long as it's not their own children, which, you know, is horrifying, right? But either way, I mean, it's what we teach our students, it's what we teach, you know, mentee teachers and ourselves, which is, if in a situation that you don't know, the proper thing to do is to listen and to collaborate and to work with people who do know, and you can learn and you can grow. And that seems to be something that our current city leadership is particularly incapable or unwilling to do, because across, I mean, if you think about this, this year, like I said, we've had, and it's growing all the time. I mean, there's more parents coming to this latest round of hearings, but we've had 20,000 community members come out and share their experiences and their insight into how to do education properly in the city of Chicago. If we were under other circumstances, we would be praising city leadership for getting that level of parent and community engagement. The problem is that if you have engagement, for it to be successful, you have to listen. And what you have are the citizens of the city of Chicago saying unanimously, don't do this. Here are other things you should be doing. And that's being completely ignored, to the point that Mayor Emanuel's appointed chief executive officer, CEO of the Chicago Public Schools, Barbara Bird Bennett, listened to the reports from her staff about those hearings and said, well, I think we can tell that everyone agrees that some schools need to be closed, when one of the most common comments at the hearings was, it's not just that I don't want my kid's school to close. Looking at how these decisions are made, I don't think any of the schools should be closed. So to have that level of civic engagement, but then completely ignore it and even twist the words of what people are saying, it's very troubling.
I've noticed one tactic that's been deployed by the powers that be on this, and it's kind of like setting an overly high baseline. I've seen in early reports about, yeah, we're probably going to be closing schools, and it could be as many as 200 schools. And then when the final numbers are revealed later, maybe 6-8 months later or something, the final number, 54 schools, at which point people are then expected to breathe a sigh of relief that, phew, we've saved 150 schools. And yet, as you had mentioned, any schools could potentially be troublesome in untold ways and for reasons that are closing them down are basically done for what amount to spurious, at best, reasons. Do you feel like this is a kind of approach that they're thinking about trying to, I guess, put the cart before the horse, massaging the numbers and making people feel like, yeah, it's unfortunate, but, you know, we saved these many schools, and just by doing this, they kind of were able to achieve some stated goal of the number of at least closing some schools?
Absolutely. I mean, I think you've got it exactly right, Mitchell. And to support your point, Barbara Bird Bennett, the current CEO, the previous CEO, Jean-Claude Brizard, they're both graduates of the Broad Foundation's program to prepare school leaders. And the Broad Foundation actually has a guide on how to close schools that was co-authored by Barbara Bird Bennett that explains this process, that you need to start with a large number that's not the number you really intend to close, so then you can negotiate down to the number you did want to close, and people will feel like they were listened to. And, I mean, to me, circulating and employing those type of tactics is about as anti-democratic as you can be, because it's purposely strategizing to diminish the public's voice in community choices. And that's, it's not just that it's unjust, I think it's ineffective governance. I don't think it leads to anything good for a city. And, I mean, it gets to these ridiculous situations where, as you work those strategies, you get bolder and bolder. And, I mean, another thing that just stands out to me is last year of the, I believe it was 5 or 6 schools they closed, they lost 11% of the students. And when I say lost, they have no idea where they are. They don't know what school they went to. They don't know what they're doing currently. And so if you're losing 11% of the students when it's, you know, 5 or 6, half dozen schools, and now you're going to do 54, I mean, I shudder to kind of think what's going to happen, right?
Yeah, the mind reel, certainly. And that actually leads me to my next question is, okay, it seems like that authorities are hell-bent on wanting to close these schools, but nonetheless, we are clearly seeing resistance in opposing this. And that's what I'd like to talk about next. What can be done to try to undo these closings? And what do you think of, although this is kind of speculative, what do you think is their relative likelihood of success?
I mean, I think this is where we all have to step back and ask those questions. We definitely need to ask those questions, but make sure that we're, you know, look internally and make sure we're asking them from a viewpoint of right and wrong and not from a, you know, almost sporting viewpoint, right? I mean, these massive issues come up in a municipal context, and we try to guess what Brahm's going to do, and we try to see what the teachers' union's going to do, and we try to see, you know, is this community going to win or lose? But I think it's really important to remember this: these are the lives of children. So, I mean, to answer your question, I'd say, I mean, we're exploring and we're learning from the history all the types of things that communities do when they're engaged and they're faced with extreme injustice. You can see already with the last action, as we discussed, approximately 150 arrests, that people are considering civil disobedience. Given the success of the Whittier sit-in at Whittier School in Tulsa last year, and some of the culture from the Occupy movement, I'm sure people are considering sit-ins and occupations. As to the likelihood, what I would say is just that that really depends on the people listening and how we and our fellow community members act. I mean, unjust things happen until people stand up and stop them. And I know as a city, even with all of the horrible things I see my students experience in Gage Park, and I know that we're in no way unique, I still believe this is a good city with a good heart. We study the Sandburg poem, you know, of Chicago, and you know, I think it when we study it, the students, even with some of the archaic language, you know, it really hits them. You know, we're gritty and we're tough, but there's something very good about us. So I think now's the time to prove it. I think, can we win? Yeah. I mean, if everyone stands up and says this is unjust and really asks themselves how far they're willing to go to protect the lives of young people, then anything is possible.
And the last question, for folks who are interested in learning more and are getting involved, what would you do? What sources would you recommend?
Absolutely. I think that Substance News always has a different viewpoint on education affairs that as compared to a lot of what's more readily accessible. You can definitely check out Core Teachers, which is our website. Don't want to give you the wrong one. I believe it's coreteachers.org,
I think.
.com. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then even there's a group called COSOS, Chicago Students Organizing to Save Our Schools. So people may be interested in what the youth are doing. This is a independent group of students from a number of the high schools that are getting together. They did a press conference last week. I believe they're holding they've announced a boycott of the second day of the mandatory state testing to try to get some attention around school closings this week, so on Wednesday. So there's a lot of action going on. Those are a couple of places or several places people can learn more and get involved. And as always, the CTUnet.com, Chicago Teachers Union website, is also a good place to find more.
We've been speaking with Shan Barrett, law and Chicago history teacher at Gage Park High School, part of the Chicago Public Schools, who's involved with CORE, the Caucus of Rank and File Educators, as well as the CTU, the Chicago Teachers Union. Shan, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Mitchell.
That was Shan Barrett, interviewed on April 21st. We're coming to you from the trenches.
Now about to witness the strength of knowledge.
Critical thinking refers to a diverse range of intellectual skills and activities concerned with evaluating information as well as our own thought in a disciplined way. When we're willing and able to examine our own capability as thinkers, acknowledging problems and weaknesses, this can help us refine our thought processes so that we learn to think and assess information in a more comprehensive way that increases our ability to identify and reject false ideas and ideologies.
It's an age-old complaint that it's not enough to say that there's a problem in the world, you have to do something about it. But while action is a necessary component of social change, sometimes activism isn't enough. One critique made by a longtime activist, Cynthia Peters, is that activists too often appear like a random action rather than as a part of a larger cohesive whole with goals, plans, strategies, and tactics. Sometimes, thinking critically and talking openly about activism, society, and the planet is the most important thing you can do. It's a topic of the new book, Arguing for Our Lives, A User's Guide to Constructive Dialogue, by Professor Robert Jensen, longtime political activist and professor of journalism at the University of Texas at Austin. We'll learn more about the book and about the topic from Professor Robert Jensen, who was interviewed by Chicago Indy Media's Mitchell Shapinchik on Sunday, April 14th this year.
Robert Jensen, thank you so much for joining us. Welcome to the show.
It's great to be with you, Mitchell. Thanks.
Tell us a little bit about what Arguing for Our Lives is about, please.
Well, I've been involved in political organizing and university teaching for the better part of the last 2-3 decades. And the book really grows out of both of those experiences. We live in what I think is appropriately called a propaganda culture, a culture in which advertising, public relations, and marketing washes over us on a daily basis. And as a result, I think some of our critical thinking skills have atrophied. And I see that both in the classroom. I also see that when I'm out in public. And so based on a lot of experience talking both to students in class and to groups in public, I wanted to think about what it means to take thinking seriously. Now, of course, in the United States, there's often a kind of pejorative connotation to the notion of intellectual life or being an intellectual. And there's certainly reasons for that. You know, I work in a university and I see a lot of intellectuals who are snobbish, elitist, kind of domineering. And I don't mean intellectual in that sense. I mean the recognition that we all have the capacity to live robust and exciting intellectual lives, that systematic attempt to understand the world. And so I guess what I'm trying to do in this book is make intellectual life exciting, which it certainly is, I think it has been for me.
And that was the point of writing the book. I just like to hear a little bit more about why you're writing the book to try to express that kind of intellectualism of sorts.
Well, I think because in the United States, we're often described as a rather anti-intellectual culture, a rejection of the results of all that systematic work. Again, sometimes people have legitimate reasons for being skeptical of professional intellectuals. This is about bringing the notion of intellectual life, you know, to our everyday lives. The other thing I think is important is often in activist circles, political organizing, people will say, well, I'm tired of talking. I want to do something. Mm. And I think this is also a recognition that when we do things, it's informed by our thinking. We're always working off of some theory about how the world works, and we're better off making that process of coming to an analysis of the world more explicit, of improving our abilities collectively to come to judgment about the world. So I think all of these reasons make it more important than ever to really focus on critical thinking.
It would seem like sometimes I'd like to explore a little bit about this kind of dichotomy versus, you know, I'm tired of thinking about something, I'm going to go do something. Sometimes I tend to think that thinking actually is doing, in fact, a very high calling of doing, especially where it's kind of like the old saying, yeah, you're not necessarily doing something, but you're maybe taking a step back in order to go two steps forward. If you didn't take that step about some kind of critical analysis or thinking about things first, you might not be able to go as far if you didn't take that step first. Is this the kind of sentiment you agree with, or what's your take on that?
Absolutely. There's two reasons that we need to think and think carefully and then talk about that thinking. One is, of course, when we take actions in the world, they should be based on our best analysis of what will be more effective. So, for instance, if one is concerned about the contemporary ecological crisis, should one put all of one's time and energy into lobbying Congress? Or should one put time and energy into building a grassroots movement to try and create new ways of thinking? Well, the answer to that question depends on what you think the nature of the crisis is. So that analysis is crucial. And as you also point out, thinking and then discussing the results of our thinking is a kind of action itself. It's politics. Politics is that mix between just simply engaging and sharing ideas and then mobilizing to affect public policy. You know, the great American social philosopher John Dewey once said, democracy begins in conversation. And I think we forget that. We often tend to think politics is nothing but a kind of technical activity of trying to apply pressure to the right places to get the right result. But I think the deepest notions of democracy include a very important part, a very important place for this notion of conversation. To be a citizen is to be able to converse, to be able to think clearly, think critically, and share that in conversation.
There were a number of thoughts that occurred to me while I was reading the book, and I'd like to get your assessment on some of these thoughts as I go through them one by one in the time of this interview. One was, in the book, you call for what you describe as an honest critical engagement. And you mentioned a number of examples about this. One in particular example that kind of struck me was where, in talking about religion, you mentioned one conversation that you have in the book where you wind up, in the course of a fairly straightforward conversation, pointing out a pretty grave contradiction in one person's thinking with regards to their faith. I can imagine if that were to happen to me, and might well have happened to this person you were talking to, that certainly would be a turnoff for them. In some ways, that actually might, in some ways, almost defeat the purpose with regards to, I don't know if the words winning over adherence might work, but at least trying to raise kind of critical questions. Aren't you concerned that maybe if you might be defeating the purpose behind this book to try to instill a kind of critical thinking by some actions like this, if you're not necessarily winning people over? I imagine the effect might be somewhat off-putting for some people. What are your thoughts with regards to this line of thinking?
Well, that's true. Of course, all of us have deep commitments to ways of thinking and understanding the world that should be challenged. And all of us are probably a little reticent to have those commitments challenged. That's true of all people, I suspect. So what I'm talking about is kind of collectively cultivating an openness to being challenged. Now, it's not going to be successful in every count. I mean, I can imagine people challenging some of my deeply held beliefs, and instead of opening me up, it might shut me down. But I think there's one important thing to remember. The value of our conversations and our attempts at honest mutual critique are important, not just for how they affect the person you might be talking to directly in that moment. So, for instance, let's say you challenge one of my deeply held beliefs today, mm-hmm. and I may shut down, resist it, reject it, tell you why you're crazy, whatever. But you've planted a seed, and it might be that somewhere down the line, when I've had more time to reflect on it, I might, in fact, come to change my beliefs. So we shouldn't measure the effect of any particular intellectual engagement in that one moment. Everybody who's been a teacher, for instance, has had the experience of having a student write you a letter, you know, 10 years after graduation and say something to the effect, you know, I used to think you were crazy, but after I was out in the world a little while, I come to see why some of what you say makes sense. So that's important. The other thing to remember is that the value of that engagement and critical engagement especially is not just on the specific person you're talking to, but on others who might be listening. So let's say, again, in this conversation, you challenged one of my deeply held beliefs and I shut down, decided I didn't want to deal with it. Well, other people on the radio will hear this and it might cause them to reflect. You know, I think it's important to realize that we are never guaranteed success in any endeavor, you know, but this is the style, the thinking and the conversational style I think we have to cultivate. An openness to being critiqued, and then equally important, a willingness to critique others. It's not just that sometimes we're unwilling to listen to critiques of ourselves. Sometimes we're afraid of critiquing others out of the possibility we might be seen as being too harsh or people won't like us. Well, you know, that's part of what it means to be a citizen in democracy, to engage even though not every interaction ends pleasantly.
Along those lines, I could see where people might want to avoid kind of some kind of constructive dialogue, not necessarily because they're afraid of dialogue or even critical dialogue, but maybe because on a more fundamental basis, they're kind of afraid of losing an argument. They had some idea or some suggestion, and they just feel like they got the floor wiped with them as far as what some kind of discussion about what sure. they thought was going to say, and no, you're wrong, and I give you a compelling reason or evidence or rationale why. And it kind of dovetails with that kind of turnoff feeling. But what are your thoughts with regards to addressing that people might just be afraid of being seen as they're having their ideas shown wrong or losing a discussion?
Yeah, I think you're right. In the moment that one loses an argument decisively, one is never happy about it. I mean, I've lost arguments, and in the moment when it was clear to me I was losing, I won't pretend I was happy about it. But on the other hand, I can look back and recognize that most of the moments in my life when I grew, whether that's intellectually, emotionally, politically, it's because I was challenged and because I lost an argument. I think back to my sort of most formative training in intellectual and political life, which was coming to terms with the feminist critique of men's violence against women and men's sexual exploitation of women. Mm-hmm. And when I went into those subjects, I had no feminist analysis, and I thought I was pretty, you know, clear about what I thought, and I thought I was right. And that challenge that I had to take seriously from feminists involved a lot of moments when I had to realize, in fact, I was wrong, that I had both misunderstood feminism and was wrong in the way I was evaluating contemporary society. There were a lot of painful moments in that process. I look back on it and even think about it today and recognize, no, it's not fun, but it's how we grow. I mean, everybody understands that you don't grow by going forward in your life without ever being challenged. So, in a sense, we just have to start being a little more serious about the kind of platitudes we often issue. So we talk about the need to be challenged, the need to grow, the way we grow from painful and uncomfortable experiences. Well, that's all true, and we just have to start, I think, living it a little more fully.
One other thought that occurred to me reading this was I could understand that some people might want to avoid discussion, mainly because, especially where people might offer challenging critiques about contemporary society in one way or another, that those critiques don't necessarily amount to an answer, whatever that answer might be. You know, you're complaining with regards to, stopping a war, or stopping widespread sexual assault, or you can pick any of a number, or helping to save the environment, any of a number of dozens or hundreds or an infinity of different possible concerns that you're pointing this out and you're probably right and I probably agree with you, but I don't want to talk about it with you because there are no answers, and so I just want to shut that off because I don't want to have to think about it. I'd rather watch a movie or do something else rather than have to address this for problem with which there are no ready answers, even if they are hard, even if I agree with that. How do you address that line of thinking?
Well, I think you're absolutely right, both in the observation that there are problems we face today that don't have easy solutions. In fact, problems that may have no solutions at all within the framework that we're used to. And you're also correct that that's a very challenging reality to face. But it is reality. And in my experience, we don't cope with reality more effectively by denying it. Take the environmental crises we face, for instance. I've said many times that there really is no solution to the problem of the contemporary ecological crisis, if by solution we mean some magic rescue that's going to allow 7 billion people on the planet to live the way we are, especially live the way we are in the more affluent first world. Well, that's true. That means that to take seriously the ecological crises is to take seriously reimagining the way we live. And, for many of us, and probably most people listening to this broadcast, the way we live is quite comfortable. I'm, a middle-class American with access to all of the food I need. I have reliable shelter and a whole lot of ways I can amuse myself at fairly low cost. And that's comfortable in a certain way. So I understand that some of these challenges are very disturbing because they implicitly, we realize we're going to have to reshape the way we live. So my only response to that is, again, that that's reality, and reality is what it is. But the other thing is to remember that these modern ways of living, these conveniences to which so many of us have become kind of almost addicted, it's a fairly recent development in human existence to live at this level of material comfort. People in other places and people historically have managed to live full, happy, and robust lives without all of the energy and material affluence we have. There's no reason to think we can't reshape our lives. So, there is a kind of payoff to critical thinking. It's not the payoff of cheap pleasure that the dominant culture offers. It's the payoff of really struggling to redefine what it means to live a good life. One of the great questions of human philosophy: what is a good life? What does it mean to live a good life? Well, that's a challenge, of course, to have to rethink the way we live, but there's also a payoff to it, and I think we have to keep our eye on that as well.
What would you define as being having a success for the publication of the book? The fact that it was published at all, the fact that it hopes to spur more dialogue, the hope that it may change policy one day. What's success for you in the context of having written and published this book?
Well, I think that more and more in my own public speaking and writing and teaching, I think what I can do as someone with status and someone with resources, as a professor at a major American research university, is I can simply validate what many people are thinking and feeling, whether it's sort of more at the intuitive level or more consciously. That is, I run into more and more people who are, quite frankly, scared about the state of our political system, scared about the economic system, and scared most profoundly about the ecological crises that we face. And around them, they don't see a lot of people talking in fairly deep and critical ways about these problems. Yes, there's a lot of political pontificating going on about the paralysis and gridlock in Washington, or the questions about how to get the economy back on track, or what are we going to do about the fossil fuel problem? Well, but there aren't sort of deep meaningful conversations going on about the depth of these crises. And people feel them. People think about it. But often they think and feel about it in isolation. I can't tell you how many times people have said to me after reading something I've written or hearing me speak, you know, I've thought the exact same thing. Now, you know, on one level, I could perhaps be disappointed because I didn't have something, you know, truly creative and original to say. But I actually take that as the highest compliment, that what I do is articulate what is on the minds of others who just don't have the same kind of platform that I have from which to speak and write. And so I think that's the most important part of this book, of my own work, and in fact, of what we might call progressive politics or critical intellectual life, is to find a way in plain language to speak the truth that so many people feel but don't feel like they have a place to discuss.
This kind of, I don't know if it dovetails, but it seems like it's connected with the idea with regards to heresy, especially in contemporary life or even in historical life. During the course of the days of, say, a figure like Thomas Aquinas, where he would have had to address accusations that what he was putting forth may have been heretical or heresy. But that would have been, some may argue that that was a day of or a time where they tried to address heresy on its face. Yeah, someone's trying to pose an argument, but we're taking it honestly, we're trying to address it, we're trying to find answers to it and think about it in a serious way. It would seem, kind of touching on what you had mentioned earlier, that that doesn't really happen in contemporary intellectual life these days. If there's heresy, all you do is basically point to it, say, that's heresy, and leave it at that, and move on and think about something else, or ignore it entirely. Well, first off, do you agree with this assessment? And secondly, do you think that this is another thing that we've got to try to challenge, to try to bring forth the kind of thinking that, yeah, there are heresies, but that doesn't mean you ignore things, you try to address them on their face?
Yeah, I think the notion of heresy trials and the notion of a very powerful elite policing the boundaries of appropriate thought and bringing to trial those who are heretical, that is to a large degree part of our past, although we shouldn't forget that that does still happen, especially in university life when people think too critically. Sometimes they do come under attack, especially at moments of great crisis, like right after 9/11, for instance. But I think the more dangerous approach, or the more dangerous reality, is not that heretical thinking or thinking that challenges the powerful is routinely the subject of a kind of heresy trial, but that it's simply ignored. I think that the dominant culture, when it bumps up against ideas it doesn't like, tends to simply ignore them. And I think this is most obvious on the, again, this crucial question of the multiple ecological crises we face. This should be front and center in every political debate. It should be front and center in every classroom. The human population today is on the verge of undermining the ability of the ecosphere to sustain large-scale human life. I mean, we are talking not about discrete little environmental problems like a dirty river here or too much smog there. We're talking about systemic threats to the health of the ecosphere. And I think the most a kind of appalling failure of both the political and intellectual cultures today is the unwillingness to put that at the center of our discussions. It's certainly taking up more of my time, more of my energy, and as I think it should be, not just for people who are perhaps scientists or specialists in climate change or ecology, but for all of us, whether we're in the humanities and the social sciences or the sciences. And the danger is the culture is just in such deep denial about it that it doesn't even bother to label such critique heresy. It simply ignores it.
I'm reminded of all things, actually, of the remake of the TV show Battlestar Galactica. There's a quote in there that says, "The day will come when you can't ignore the things that you've done." And I wonder if that might be a day of reckoning. And actually, that might be the kind of thing like, yeah, ignore it now, but the day will come when you can't ignore whatever it is that you have done or are doing, even to the level of just even considering ideas.
Absolutely.
Do you agree with that?
Yeah, and there's a... This is not new in human history. If you go back into the theological literature, you quickly find there's a longstanding, what's often called prophetic tradition, that tradition of people within a society calling out the abuses of the dominant culture. And that means not only calling out the abuses of the powerful, it's not only criticizing the king, it's criticizing the way an entire society can become complacent and complicit, therefore, in the injustice, in the environmental degradation, whatever the problem might be. And, of course, the problem of prophets is that they are often not listened to in the moment they bring an important message, and it's only later that the prophetic nature of their calling is understood. So this is not a new problem. People have long been seduced by material affluence, by comfort, by status. It's just that today, I think the stakes are so much higher. In, you know, what we always like to call this globalized world, we know that problems can no longer be kept local. A political crisis in one arena of the world is not merely local. Environmental destruction is not local, it's global. And therefore, there are chips on the table that have never been there before. So this tendency of dominant cultures and powerful people to encourage denial, to encourage people to accept those sort of seductive goodies that an affluent culture can offer, I think is more critical than ever to challenge. Of course, it's not easy, but, you know, criticizing dominant culture has never been easy anywhere.
Let me ask one last question, actually a more mundane question related to the book itself. What's been the response to the book so far? I mean, it's just published, but what have people been talking about it and thinking about it? What's been the response?
Well, I think a lot of the material in the book I've been, you know, thinking about and talking about in public for a long time. And I think that the reaction to it is split depending on the nature of the audience. For the official culture, for people, you know, in positions of status and authority, I think the ideas we're talking about here are kind of dismissed as trivial, as, you know, overly wrought political analysis, you know, hysteria. When you bring up these sort of fundamental issues about living in a propaganda culture, about denying the nature of multiple crises, people in power, people with authority, they tend to say, well, you know, as always, people in authority will take care of these problems and all you people fretting about it should just kind of go home. But as I said, among ordinary people, when we raise these kinds of subjects collectively, we find that a lot of people are struggling, a lot of people are scared, and scared for perfectly sensible reasons, because we do face crises that really do present new challenges to humanity. So I think, as is often the case, how a book or a way of thinking is received depends very much on the audience. And I'm much more interested in speaking with ordinary people, speaking with people in grassroots political movements, and speaking to students. Maybe it's counterintuitive, but in some ways, I think young people are more open to this. They're hungry for something authentic. A lot of the first-year students I teach, they sort of know at some level that the mythology of America they've been handed is inadequate to understand the world, and they're looking for a framework that can help them understand the world more deeply and honestly. And so I'm hopeful on that count that young people are eager and willing to do this kind of very difficult critical thinking.
That was Professor Robert Jensen, longtime political activist and professor of journalism at the University of Texas at Austin, who was interviewed on April 14th. The book, Arguing for Our Lives, is available online from the publisher, City Lights Publishers, at citylights.com. That concludes this episode of From the Trenches. If you'd like to learn more and get involved in making media, including how to help make this radio program, please visit the website of the Chicago Independent Media Center at chicago.indymedia.org or call 773-384-8544. I'm Bree Hayden. Thank you for listening, and please join us again for another episode From the Trenches.